It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Bible is the most read book of all time. It raises many questions, and for billions of people around the world, it provides answers. But where did the Bible come from? That's a big question. Archaeologist and biblical scholar Robert Cargill has worked long and hard and traveled far to find an answer to that question. He's written about what he found in his new book, The Cities That Built the Bible, and he is with me now. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with your inspiration for the book. As a biblical scholar, I'm sure that the question of where did the Bible come from is one that you've given a lot of thought to. But in the introduction to the book, you write about the person who asked that question that kind of provided the catalyst for this whole journey. And that person was, surprisingly enough, Nicole Kidman, the actress. Yeah. So tell me how that happened.
Yeah, I was teaching as an adjunct while I was working on my PhD at UCLA. I was teaching at Pepperdine University, which is a Christian college in Malibu, California. It's very pretty down there. While I was teaching, a member of the local community came and sat in the classroom, because I have this open classroom policy. If you want to come in and listen, you're welcome to do that. And at the end of one of the classes, she said, "I have this friend who I'd like to invite to come, but it'll be too much of a distraction. So I'd like you to go to her house and maybe work with her. Just do the same thing you're doing here, but work with her." And I said, "Yeah, I'm happy to. You know, a friend of yours is a friend of mine." And she goes, "By the way, it's Nicole Kidman." And I tried to keep a straight face and not, you know, and he said, "Well, like I said, you know, a friend of yours is a friend of mine." And so I began to work with Ms. Kidman. And I found that in addition to being incredibly gracious and incredibly smart, she's actually very, very smart. She asked a lot of the very smart questions that a lot of the students who were in the class were asking. And one of these questions that I get from students and that I got from Ms. Kidman was, where did the Bible actually come from? Because there's this notion that it just floated down out of the sky as a complete document, kind of like, you know, we envision the law being given to Moses on Mount Sinai, like here are the tablets. But that's not actually how we got the Bible. And as different students were asking this question repeatedly, I kept saying, well, you know, it came from, there was this stuff in the what we call the Old Testament of the Hebrew Bible. Then we get some later stuff that didn't make it into the Bible. Then we've got the New Testament. Then we've got some later stuff that didn't make it in. And I understood after a while that I'm going to have to write this stuff down and try to do so in an entertaining way that anyone can understand.
Now, I was struck by the fact that In looking at the question, where did the Bible come from, you are exploring a different question from who wrote the Bible, which is another question that gets asked a lot. So explain for me how the approach is different when you ask the question in a different way.
Right. In the same way that the Bible, you know, we ask the question, where did it come from? One of the first things we have to acknowledge is that many different people wrote it. And we know that that's not just true about the New Testament. So you've got these four different authors of the Gospels who are anonymous. I mean, they get attributed names later, but we have these four different Gospels. We have the writings of Paul. We have other people writing in the name of Paul. Scholars think that many of the letters that Paul wrote, he didn't really write. They're at least the ones that are attributed to him. And then the same is true for the Hebrew Bible. So we have this tradition that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, but scholars began to question, you know, how did Moses write about his death? You know, how did this? And then we have these other chronicles, and you realize that the Bible is written over such a long period of time, including, you know, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, that you begin to move away from the question of who wrote it. Who, you know, what was the name of the person or who were the people who wrote it? And you begin to approach it as what contributed to it? What were the events? What were the cultures, entire cultures, that contributed to the composition of the Bible? And that's the question that I wanted to approach. Not, you know, who was the author or what were they like or why did they say what they said, but what was the catalyst for – what were the inspirations for the events that are recorded in the Bible, and then why did someone choose to write all this down? Because for a long time, this was just oral tradition. This was just tales that were passed down. And then traumatic things happened that caused you, we better write this down. And so they would write it down, and then they, of course, would edit it. And then that, what we call the Hebrew Bible, became the scripture for the different Jewish groups that were in what we call the first century, the New Testament period. So you've got the people who believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. These become the Christians. You've got the Pharisees, the Sadducees. You've got zealot groups. You've got the Essenes. You've got all of these different groups who are looking at these Hebrew scriptures differently. They're interpreting them differently, in part because of the different influences on them at the time.
So talking about the different cultures of the different cities, the mm-hmm. different places where people lived. And in your book, you, in the very beginning, you go back to the beginning of the written word.
Right. Right. If you're going to talk about, you know, how we got the Bible, you need to talk about the things that make the Bible possible, which is paper and which is, you know, the alphabet. So one of the things that many people are interested or surprised to learn is that the Greek language that makes up the New Testament and Aramaic and Hebrew, which make up the Hebrew Bible, all stem from the same alphabet. And this goes back to Phoenicia. And so the earliest alphabet comes from Phoenicia. And there were some earlier proto-alphabets that we find, you know, as early as the 18th century BCE in the Sinai Peninsula in modern Egypt. But it's this Phoenician alphabet, this consonantal alphabet, that meant that you didn't have to memorize 5,000 different pictures or signs, that you could just learn 22 different graphemes, you know, symbols that represent sounds. And that alphabet went west to Greece and inspired the Latin alphabet as well, but also became the Semitic alphabet, which of course gives rise to Aramaic and Hebrew, ultimately to Arabic much later. And then, of course, these three languages, Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew, make up the Bible. So we even get the name Bible from the city of Byblos on the coast of on the Phoenician coast. So I started with Phoenicia because in order to have a Bible, you've got to have the things that allow you to write a Bible, namely, you know, an alphabet and paper.
In looking at the origin of writing in relation to the Bible, does that also indicate that the beginnings of the Bible, that was one of the first things that people were writing down and sharing widely?
There were chronicles, let's say. There were histories that other cultures that predated ancient Israel, what we would call the Israelites, had made. So we know that the Sumerians, we know that the cultures from Mesopotamia were writing things down. We call this the earliest writing. Cuneiform comes from over there. We've also got Egypt on the other side, you know, to the south and to the west of Israel, who are writing things down. And a lot of these are monumental inscriptions. They're recording battles and they're essentially kings bragging about people they killed, right? They're, I conquered these guys and I conquered these guys. But we also see a phenomenon of narrative. And so people begin to write epics. So we get epics like Gilgamesh, these stories of adventures. And so we begin to see the birth of actual literature, which is, you know, I think it's quite interesting to be in the city of literature here in Iowa City, talking about the origin of the first pieces of literature that we have. And so we move from chronicles and myths, you know, stories and adventures, down to people writing about their own history. So when the state of Israel, the ancient kingdom of Israel is established, they need to write their own chronicles. And of course, they begin to retell a lot of the stories that they know. And this is the beginnings of the stories that built the Bible.
You also, as you travel, you look at the stories of other deities.
Mm-hmm.
And you take some of those stories and compare them to stories in the Bible. Tell me what you found.
Yeah. And many scholars have done this before me, Mark Smith being one of the most prominent ones, who's written about basically the early history of God, that the rise of the Hebrew God actually comes much later than many of the other deities that we've known about from ancient Egypt, but specifically for our purposes, Phoenicia and Ugarit. And so the deities that we read about in the Bible, that the prophets are always, you know, running around saying, stop worshiping these guys, stop worshiping these guys. These were very well-known popular deities just to the north of Israel in Phoenicia and Ugarit. So, for instance, Baal. Baal is, you know, the fertility god. He's a storm god. El is kind of the grandfather god. I call him the deity emeritus, right? He's kind of the earliest god, but he's kind of honored for things that he did a long time ago. And then you've got other deities like Asherah, which we read about in the Bible. Baal we read about in the Bible. And then there's other deities that are hidden. So for instance, the god of the sea is Yam in Phoenician and ancient Ugarit. And in Hebrew, Yam is not a deity, but it's still the word for the sea. So they depersonified it or de-deified it. And the same with death, right? The god of death is Mot, and death has this battle with Baal in some of the Ugaritic literature, the literature that we discovered in ancient Ugarit. And in Hebrew, you have, I think, a couple of instances in Hebrew poetry where death is still personified. But the Hebrew word for death is Mot. So they just took away the divine element and just made it the generic word. And these different terms, these different deities that we read about in the Bible, actually we have evidence for them. We have archaeological evidence. We have statues. We have figurines. We have texts about these gods from much earlier that predate ancient Israel.
Interesting. And you write about the difference between the idea of monotheism and then – you contrast that with the idea of I believe in one God, but I recognize that there are these other gods.
Correct. So the another question that I get a lot from students is, what exactly is monotheism? And it's an interesting question because we know that ancient Israel was polytheistic. Now, they came to a point where they endorsed officially the belief in only one deity, the Hebrew God. But we know that the people were worshiping all these other gods because the prophets are saying, stop worshiping these other gods. It's like when you walk down the Ped Mall or walk down the street and you see, you know, no skateboarding. That's a pretty good indication that people are skateboarding. So people are worshiping all of these gods. And at some point, the official decree is monotheism. That is, there is one God. But does that mean that you can't allow for the existence of other gods? So we call this monolatry, the worship of one God, while allowing for other gods, versus the belief in only one God.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Robert Cargill. He's just published the book, The Cities That Built the Bible. He's assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the origin of the Bible. With me is Robert Cargill. He is an assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa, a biblical scholar, an archaeologist. His most recent book is The Cities That Built the Bible. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. And Bob, one of the things that struck me as you took your journey in the book is so many of the places that we sort of instantly think of when we think of biblical history are kind of the last cities on your list.
Correct.
Nazareth and Jerusalem, right, et cetera. So as you began your journey, why not hit those cities at
right.
the beginning?
Well, I like to, as one who is trained in Second Temple Judaism, that is Hebrew Bible and then leading up into the backgrounds of the New Testament, I like to remind, especially Christians, that 70% of your Bible is Hebrew Bible. 70% of the Bible is Old Testament. And that the Bible that the first century Christians used when they refer to Scripture is the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, because the New Testament hadn't been written yet. It hadn't been pulled together. And so I thought it was important to tell the story of the origins of the Bible from the beginning. So, you know, where did we get writing? Where did we get paper? And then, you know, who was Assyria? Who was Babylon? Because these, you know, Assyria and Babylon had huge impacts, not only on the actual existence of the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, but those were the things that caused later Jews in the Second Temple period, coming back from exile from Babylon, to reflect upon. They're forming their opinions about God and about how God works and what God wants based upon these very traumatic things that happened to them. And so I thought it was important to tell the stories of Babylon, of, you know, Nineveh representing Assyria, Babylon obviously representing the Babylonians, to tell the story of the Persians, then to tell the story of what happened to Judaism when the Greeks showed up. So we have chapters on Athens and Alexandria, which we call this Hellenizing Judaism. It fundamentally altered Judaism. And then it's in that world that we see the birth of Christianity. And so many scholars know this. Nazareth and Bethlehem, even though they're huge in the stories of Jesus, are actually very insignificant when it comes to the composition of the Bible or reflection upon it. They just happen to be the places that are associated with Jesus. Jerusalem, even, is the center of Judaism, but we don't get a lot of things written there. So I do tell it in a way chronologically from the origins. How did we get the beliefs that became the books that were reflecting on these beliefs? And so these books, Rome obviously plays a huge role, all come towards the end of the book.
Now, let's spend a little bit of time talking about Babylon, because as an archaeologist, you have spent time in what is ancient Babylon, searching for the archaeological record. Tell me a little bit about the project you were working on there.
Right. So we have an active excavation working with Tel Aviv University in Israel at a site called Tel Azekah. And this is about halfway between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean. And Tel Azekah was one of these border cities, between the Philistines, we read about in the Bible, and Judah. In fact, the valley that runs just below Tel Azekah is the setting for the story of David and Goliath, the very famous story of David and Goliath. And I have never I tell about my travels to most of these cities. I've never been to Babylon because when I graduated high school, there was a war going on, and there has basically been war there ever since. But my encounter with the Babylonians comes 5 meters underground at Tel Azekah. I was digging out a cistern. We discovered this water system, and we were digging, and we were just finding, you know, stuff. We were just finding kind of rubble. And then all of a sudden, as we're getting close to the bottom, I begin to uncover remains, and I just assumed that there were dog bones and goats and things that fall in a well. But I very quickly, discover human remains. And this is not uncommon for the bottoms of cisterns, because later, as cisterns are put out of use, people don't use them anymore, they just become places where you can dump people. And so I'm coming across these human remains, and I'm 5 meters underground, and it's in the dark, and I'm trying to balance emotionally my professional life. That is, my job is to document this and to write down. This appears to be a femur. This is a skull. And you find multiple skulls, right? And you find skulls of what appear to be adults. And then you find a little child. You find this little – that it was just discarded. This family was just disposed of. It wasn't a proper burial. They were just discarded. And the professional side of me that's trying to remain stoic and is running into the part of me that's a father, that has newborn twins at home. And I'm thinking to myself, how do you do this? I mean, what happened to these, what's the story of these people? And it's there that you're reminded that archaeology isn't about the stones and it's not about the walls. It's about the people who built those walls. Archaeology is the story of human history. And so I'm sitting there beginning to cry, and I'm a pretty stoic person, and I basically just turned off my headlamp, so it's completely pitch black, and I just started crying, right there, because somebody had to. And it's there that I begin to understand the texts in the Bible that refer to the Babylonians, the Book of Lamentations. I began to understand what happened, because just below, after we excavated these remains, we found the destruction layer. So under this destruction layer, this Azekah is a vibrant city, and it's got pottery that dates back to the kingdom of Judah. Above that, after this destruction, it's just a place where you throw things, you discard things, including humans. And that was when I came into very visceral contact with the destructions of the Babylonians, with what the Babylonians did to ancient Israel, because I'm sitting there weeping over a family that I don't even know, but somebody needed to cry for them. I owed it to them.
So there you are you're touching the history that is told in the Bible. How does that change your experience of reading these documents?
People talk about a religious experience, right? As a historian and as an archaeologist, this is the religious experience, right? I like to travel places. I teach, you know, a lot of ancient history, and I like to touch that history. For some reason, when you pick up a coin that nobody's touched for 2,000 years, that history becomes very real, whether it's a religious artifact or not. When you touch the Western Wall, you know, the retaining wall that Herod the Great built, that's, for Jews, a very, very religious experience, and also for many Christians. But for a historian, that's also incredibly valuable. When we're uncovering things that nobody's seen for 2,500, 3,000 years, we're not just finding things and we get our name published and we get our pictures and finding shiny things. We're actually looking through a window into the lives of my, you know, great, 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 great ancestors. This is the lives of early humanity. And as one who's committed to teaching and understanding, teaching the humanities, what could be more powerful than that? I'm touching history.
I'm talking with Robert Cargill. His most recent book is The Cities That Built the Bible. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Peter is on the line from West Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Very interesting conversation. And from my point of view, being a Persian and Armenian, we have the opposite end of this story, of course, because our ancient ancestry of Cyrus the Great, having freed the Jews from Babylonia and then helped them return to Israel and rebuild the temple. So you have two sides of a story that is fascinating to everybody in the Middle East.
Yeah, I tell at the end of the Babylon chapter, I actually talk about the rise of Persia. And we look at some of the artifacts, including the Cyrus cylinder, the actual decree that allowed everybody that the Babylonians had captured and exiled into Babylon to go back home, to go free. And so I have a photo of the cylinder. I actually look at the translations of what the Bible says versus what the cylinder says. And you can see that when the Persians come to power, they're thinking more diplomatically. They're thinking, we can better rule these people that we, and you know, these kingdoms that we inherited when we took over the Babylonians, if we allow them to maintain their own temples. And so that it's this new Persian understanding of diplomacy, even though they were very fierce warriors, it was their diplomacy. This idea that we understand that we're ruling over people who don't necessarily believe in our deities, so we'll allow them to have their own temples, and we'll basically administer the cities that we these foreign cities that we've now that we now rule over through the temples. And so you'll note that the Persians didn't allow the Jewish monarchy to come back, the Judean monarchy, but they did allow them to have the priesthood, and they basically allowed the people to have their faith, to have their some extent of freedom in their homeland. And that tradition, I think, is a powerful one because it serves as an example of perhaps a good way to govern is to allow people some freedom, allow people to worship in the way that they want to. They're far less likely to rebel against you when you do that. And if I can just a quick comment on the Armenians, many people don't realize that prior to the Romans, the Armenian people are actually the first group to adopt Christianity. In fact, an entire quarter of the old city of Jerusalem is called Armenian Jerusalem. It's the Armenian quarter. And so the Armenians have arguably the longest Christian history, especially in Jerusalem.
Peter, thank you so much for calling and bringing that up. We have another caller on the line, and as we travel further and move into the Greek influence, Jim has a question for you from West Des Moines. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The question I wanted to ask, and this is very, very interesting, is the whole development in the Bible, which seems to me that the dominating unifying thing in the Old and New Testament is this development of the concept of providential history. And it seems to me it revolves around, it seems like the biblical discovery of some sort of linear history, some sort of belief that there's actual meaning in history itself, unlike the Greek view, which there really is no meaning in history, and that It centers around the fall of Jerusalem. And I would particularly like to ask your guest about Isaiah, which, of course, is written over hundreds of years and has several writers. And in there you have the notion that Cyrus is indeed the first Messiah. He's the first one who's an agent of God leading providential history. And it seems to me so much of the Old Testament is written upon this idea of reestablishing Jerusalem after they've gone into exile. And it unifies their whole view of things. And somehow there is a one God in charge of history who rules all the other emperors of the world. And I wondered if you could explicate on this a bit.
Sure. This is a wonderful, wonderful question. It's a very informed question. So I want to deal with the history part first, and then we'll talk about Cyrus. I think you're absolutely right. The notion what I argue in the conclusion is that, you know, we shouldn't view the Bible as a set, you know, of blueprints, of rules that, you know, this is how you are to act. And but the Bible is actually, and the different authors of the Bible are actually chronicles of people attempting to wrestle with what they believe to be God breaking into history. This notion that things do happen. It's not just one big cycle, that ancient Israelites and Judeans believed that God was at work, and they made reflections, they built things, they made decisions based upon this. And that after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and exiled the people, what happens? What happens when God appears to not be keeping his promise? And so you get this rise of what we call apocalyptic messianism, because the first messiahs were the anointed kings, right? Every king of Israel is anointed. He's the anointed one. So, you know, you're looking at Saul and then David and Solomon, and these are all Hezekiah. These are anointed leaders of Israel. These are the anointed ones. By the way, the high priests are the other people in ancient Israel that are anointed. So you have kind of a priestly anointed one, and then you have the divine, the royal one, pardon me, the royal Messiah. When we come back from Babylon, the Persians allow the high priesthood to be reestablished, but they do not allow the Davidic monarchy to be reestablished. Therefore, there's no more royal Messiah. So the question becomes, what happened to this promise in 2 Samuel 7 that there will always be, you know, a king in Jerusalem over, you know, a son of David? And people begin to look to the sky. They begin to try to reinterpret this messianic promise. And some people look to the heavens for this one like a son of man, somebody like a human that'll come back out of the sky. But other people, like your caller mentioned in Isaiah 45, look to the Persians. And you've got this very interesting verse in Isaiah 45 that says, Cyrus, and they use the word Mashiach. This is the word, my anointed one, and he will lead the people back. That is to say that in Isaiah 45, you have this understanding that a foreign king, a Persian, is actually being called the Messiah, because he's in fact delivering the Jews back to Jerusalem. So Isaiah 45 has no problem calling a foreign king, a non-Jew, a Messiah. Later, as we move down into the 2nd century BC, this becomes a problem, because now you've got one of the messiahs is a Persian. So we begin to see literature that doesn't make it into the Bible. This is part of the Apocrypha, the Deuterocanon, which I talk about in the chapter on Alexandria. That some of these documents begin saying, basically, to fix this problem, that Cyrus converted. Basically, he became a worshiper of Daniel's God, you know, of the Hebrew God, and therefore he's eligible to be the Messiah. So that's one of the ways that they resolve that. But it is true that the Bible is written by people reflecting upon what they believe to be God at work in history. And so the Bible is actually a collection of reflections, and no, they don't all match. People have difference of opinions. People understood God acting differently, just like we would look at any historical event and see different perspectives on that. So the Bible wasn't written to be systematic and harmonized and without contradiction. Quite the opposite. The Bible is a collection of different reflections from different authors giving different perspectives into what they believe was God at work in history.
And I want to spend more time talking about how we came to have the Bible that we have today, because when we're talking about all of these different influences and all of those individuals who must have been involved in this and the different languages that the Bible was written in, obviously there are lots and lots of elements at play. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Robert Cargill. His most recent book is The Cities That Built the Bible. He's an archaeologist and a biblical scholar. He's assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa. And you are welcome to join this conversation with your questions, your observations at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the origins of the Bible. With me is Robert Cargill. He's author of The Cities That Built the Bible. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, we were starting to talk about how all of these different things came together and became the Bible that we know today. And Heidi from Fairfield had a question on the subject. She said, is Job the oldest book in the Bible? And how did they decide the order of the book? So that's a really big question. But sure. What do we know about that?
Yeah, Job is an interesting, any Hebrew scholar will tell you, Job's just an interesting book, right? It's one of the hardest books to read because so many of the words that are found in the book of Job are only used once, right? So it's hard with ancient language, if you have the same word being used in three or four contexts, you can kind of use the context to determine what the words mean. In Job, you've got these words that we only find once, and it's poetry. So you're trying to interpret poetry using words that you don't really know. The reason that that many people of faith believe Job to be an old book is because it purports to tell the story of a patriarch, you know, one of these early people. The fact is that the book of Job as we have it, while it may be older, is probably not one of the oldest texts. I mean, it's just very difficult to date. What I point out in the book is that you do have a version, let's call it, or maybe a book that inspired what we have as the Hebrew Book of Job from Ugarit. And so some of the texts that we find from Ugarit are actually tales about a very wise, righteous man who loses all of his family, and then he has this encounter with the God, with God or with gods, and ultimately gets his family back. But in the meantime, his integrity is questioned, and it looks and sounds a lot like the Book of Job. So I write in the book that what we have is the Book of Job, which is actually an ancient poem that is bookended by some prose. And I argue that the first couple chapters of Job and the last, 42, 6, 7, and beyond are actually later additions to the book of Job, who don't like the fact that someone who was very faithful to God lost everything. So how do you fix that? Well, you add something on where, he gets it all back. Or maybe that is part of the original text, just like it is in the text from Ugarit. So Job's again, any Hebrew scholar, when I was learning Hebrew at UCLA and doing my PhD, we always talk about reading Job, and it's like, it's really hard. That's an advanced thing. As far as the order of the books, Jews today, modern Jews, put the books of the Bible in a little different order than Christians. And the order in which they appear are the order of the story, not the order in which they were written. So the first five books, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, aren't the first books written. And then you've got – but they're placed – because they're telling the origin of the world and of time and the creation of the earth. Then you've got kind of the story of the formation of ancient Israel, so in Joshua and Judges, then the monarchy and Samuel and Kings. And so they're placed chronologically, even though they weren't written in that order. The oldest texts in the Bible aren't necessarily complete books. They're songs. And so you've got this famous Song of the Sea, you know, after the Exodus story, you've got this song. And the Hebrew in that song, the Song of Moses, is a very old form, early form of Hebrew. So we actually have pieced within these books of the Bible epigraphic claims, you know, things that you would find, claims like when Hezekiah talks about all the things he destroyed. This is something that you would find on monumental architecture or songs or psalms. Some of the psalms, some of the text of Isaiah is probably the oldest text in the Bible.
Let's go to the phones. Frank is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm giving Frank from Dubuque. I'm giving a talk this Sunday at the Unitarians in Dubuque, and it's on how Jesus became God, and it's based on two books by that book by Ehrman, and then also Zealot by Aslan. So I'm interested in the professor's comment on these, and I guess one question would be, I always found it fascinating that there have been many gospels or many, but it turns out that there's they've only picked out four out of maybe up to 30 for the New Testament. And so I'd be interested in, like, where were those other Gospels found, and any comment on that?
Sure. This is a good question. First, on how Jesus became God, of course, Bart Ehrman wrote this book a little while back. Look, he's a good scholar, and I think he does a good job of at least asking these penetrating questions that not necessarily everybody wants to hear. But yes, there was a fight in early Christianity over whether or not – well, first of all, whether or not Jesus was God, and what does that actually mean? And then the second question following shortly thereafter was, how did he become God? That is, was he born naturally, as any other human would be, and then God adopted him as a son of God, which we read this in the Beatitudes, you will be called a son of God. So was he so righteous that God kind of adopted him as his own son, and he became a child of God? Or was he born that way? Was he begotten as God? And you can look, the history of the early church councils are just fights about this, you know, what's the nature of Jesus? Obviously, what became Orthodox Christianity was the belief that Jesus was in fact divine. And even though Paul doesn't talk about any miraculous birth of Jesus, and Mark and John don't talk about any miraculous birth of Jesus, Matthew and Luke add these birth stories. Mark, the first gospel written, Mark, doesn't really care about where Jesus came from. He just cares about what he taught and what he was saying, what he did. Matthew and Luke needed to show, no, he's from God. And what I talk about in my Bethlehem and Nazareth chapter is that the two birth narratives, the one that we see in Luke and the one that we see in Matthew, do not match. There's stark discrepancies between the timings off, where they lived, are off. And there's actually very little, who came to visit them. These are very different stories. And over time, they get harmonized. So when you go to a department store, you basically see an amalgam, a harmonization. Luke says three shepherds came, Luke says that shepherds came to visit Jesus. Matthew says that these magi, these wise men, came to visit Jesus. And so when you go to the department store, you see all six of them standing there, right? And so they're merging these two stories together. So the debate over how Jesus became God was a serious debate early on, with the ultimate being that he always was part of God, and that was, you know, the Trinity and the formation of that. But that's centuries later. The other question is an excellent one about there were many, many Gospels, and many of them, most of them, did not make it into the Bible, the vast majority of them. What I point out in my chapter on Rome at the end, on the actual process of canonization, is that the Gospels of Matthew, that came to be called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were never really in question. Mark was written first. When Matthew, whoever wrote Matthew and whoever wrote Luke, have a copy of Mark in front of them, and they're copying parts of Mark and then adding some things to it. And then John is just out of left field. Technically, he's out of the heavens, right? John's just got Jesus. It's a different kind of gospel, and it doesn't match what we call the three synoptic gospels. But there were other gospels that made incredible claims about Jesus, many of which we consider Gnostic. That is, they believe things about Jesus that did not conform to what became Orthodox Christianity. And so they were just rejected at the outset. The big battle was, what do we do with a lot of these smaller letters? So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were never in question. Acts was never in question. Romans and Galatians, you know, these were never in question. But what do we do with James? What do we do with, you know, 3 John and Jude? What do we do with Hebrews? What do we do with the Apocalypse of John, commonly known as the Book of Revelation? We have, over the first 3 centuries, arguments, different prominent people within Christianity making different claims about whether or not these books should be included. And it got to be so confusing that when we look at our oldest known full copy of the Bible, Codex Sinaiticus, or one of the oldest Bibles that we have, there are actually books in the earliest Bible, you know, complete Bible that we have, that are no longer in the Bible, like the Shepherd of Hermas, right? You've got these texts that were actually in early Bibles that were later, people said, yeah, we're not going to put that in the Bible. So this idea of canon, of what truly is the Word of God, is not, it wasn't just decreed from on high. Different Christian groups, different bishops, different translators argued about this and debated about this for a very long time, well into the 4th century and beyond.
Well, and that raises the question, when did that stop? Because the Bible, as we know it today, is not a document that you get to insert gospels into.
Correct. I mean, you're not supposed to, right? The answer is that it really doesn't. And here's what I mean by that. Different religious groups accept different canons. So basically everybody accepts Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But Protestants, for instance, do not accept the books that were in the Hebrew, the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible called the Septuagint. Whereas Catholics today will accept those books. We're talking about Tobit and Sirach and Maccabees and you know, the additions to Daniel and these books because they were in the Septuagint. They were in the Bible at one point. So Catholics will have this thing called the Apocrypha, the Deuterocanon. The Ethiopic Church will accept the Book of First Enoch, right? When most people have never heard of the Book of First Enoch, but this is part of their canon. The group that's responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls, whatever we call them, the Essenes or the Qumranites, they had books like Jubilees. They had books like Enoch that were ultimately not in the Bible, but they considered them not only holy and were, they had many, many copies of them. They were very important. They had extra psalms that we don't have in the Bible today. So different religious groups, different Jewish groups, including Christians and then later different Christian groups, all had different Bibles. And that's a lot of the lot of the controversy is if you can't decide on what is the authoritative canon of Scripture, then it's hard to argue doctrine.
So once you have – and I realize you did a lot of research that didn't even make it into the book. So once you've traveled to all these places and you've brought all of these elements together – what does it mean? How does it change our understanding of the Bible to know about these different influences?
Right. I think ultimately the importance of the book, if I can be so bold, is to give an approach to the Bible that many people don't realize is an actual approach to the Bible. A lot of people, including myself, were raised to believe that this is the Word of God. You know, this has stood for, you know, thousands of years. And this is a blueprint, and this is – there's another way to approach the Bible, and that is, as I said earlier, that these are reflections of very faithful people, Jews, Christians. These are their honest, faithful reflections about what they believe, how they see God, or what they believe to be God, breaking into history. And they're writing this down in good faith, and they're trying to make sense of the bad things that happen, right? If God is this good, loving God – why are things so bad? Why are we being destroyed? Why are we being persecuted? It's the Babylonians. It's the Assyrians. Later, it's the Romans, right? The Greeks are oppressing the Jews. The Romans are oppressing the Christians. How is this? Why is this so? And what the Bible actually is a collection of the faith, if you will, of different faithful people. These are reflections by very faithful people from their own perspectives about what it means to be faithful to God. And no, they don't always agree and they don't always match, but that's okay.
you are going to be bringing some of this information to a much broader audience. You're going to be hosting the second season of the program Finding Jesus.
Yeah, for CNN. CNN was kind enough back in November to fly me over to the Holy Land, and I get to do my very favorite thing to do, and that is, you know, climb around things in the Holy Land and point at them and explain them, right? And so CNN wants to do a second season of this. They brought me over there. And, of course, I had just written this book, so a lot of this material is fresh in my head. A lot of these places that they took me to, I hadn't actually been to. So there's actually some new discovery for me, and I got to be, this makes sense because, and then I would. Next spring, probably around next Easter, season two of Finding Jesus will be there, and you'll see me hopefully in my Hawkeye gear. I've got pictures of me in all kinds of Tiger Hawk stuff. Running around the Holy Land and telling you why it's important.
In your book, you several times say, you know, I want you to read this and understand this, but I also want people who are interested in this history to travel to these places. Why is that important? Why do you think that matters?
I think that the best way to learn is to travel. If you want to get rid of bigotry, if you want to get rid of narrow-mindedness, go see how other people do things. And instead of just reading about it, which is incredibly powerful, go and visit it. I find it for me personally, I can remember something better if I do it, right? So if you teach me how to do something, you tell me how to do something, that's one thing. If I go and actually do it, I'm an apprentice to someone else who's done this before. That's how I started going to Israel, right? I was a student and I went on a tour, and I went on the tour bus, and I, you know, heard all the stories, and I just fell in love with this. And so what I like to do is actually travel to see these things, to make new discoveries, to go into the old city and get lost, try to get lost, and then work my way back out. And I thought it was important for my wife to do this with me. I mean, she loves to travel, and you know, she's all, you know, what are you doing all these time in the office? And what is there? I said, well, let me take you. Let's go and do this. And so, one of the best trips of my life was actually taking Rosalind, my wife, and doing the research for this trip and discovering places that some I haven't been, but also taking her to places that I have been and showing her, letting her touch them, watching her discover some of these places. It keeps me forever young and forever desiring to explore, to discover.
Some of these places are in terrible danger right now.
Right.
As you watch what's happening with ISIL and in current events, what are you worried that we'll lose?
First and foremost, it's the people. Again, archaeology isn't about the stuff. It's about the people who made the stuff. And so my heart goes out to these individuals who are dying. But what they're also losing is their cultural heritage. This is their own history. And some people who don't like that part of their history are blowing it up and destroying it. And this needs to stop.
Robert Cargill, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Cargill is an assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa. His most recent book is The Cities That Built the Bible. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.